For me, it was an honor to be invited to speak at the 2014 Rethinking Hell Conference, which took place in Houston at the Lanier Theological Library. There were several other speakers. While we didn't all see eye to eye on everything, what we had in common was a willingness to reconsider the traditional teaching of hell, the traditional view that those who reject God's grace will be tortured for all time. And I think that question needs to be reconsidered. This is no small issue. But if you're listening to these podcasts, hoping to come to a conclusion on the matter, this isn't really the right place. I've tackled the subject of the nature of hell. I call it terminal punishment because I believe that once the punishment is finished, we cease to exist. That is, that hell itself terminates. I have presented the evidence for that position in a paper on terminal punishment, which came out in the early 1990s. And I went further in one of the chapters of my 2013 release, the book on heaven and hell. So that's not the purpose of these podcasts. I'll explain the purpose when I give you the full title. But these podcasts are an adaptation of my class in Houston, which is actually becoming a chapter in a new book. And I'll let you know another time about that book. So I would suggest, if you're not familiar with the alternate view, the mainstream traditional view being infinite torment, if you're not familiar with the alternate view, you might want to read my paper before listening to this podcast. And I'd like to give you the title, I hope it doesn't scare you away, of this lesson, and then I'll read the abstract, which appears normally before scholarly articles so that you can see at a glance what it's all about. And then I'll need a couple of podcasts to get it all out because I'll be sharing this chapter. The title was Doctrinal, Biblical, and Psychological Obstacles to Accepting Conditionalism: Successfully Rethinking Hell in a Small Christian Movement. That's the title. Let me give you the abstract. Given the benefits in terms of implications for divine mercy and proclaiming the gospel, one would think that conditionalism would receive a hearty and global welcome. I'll pause for a moment to explain that term. Conditionalism is the position that no one is immortal. We're not unconditionally immortal. Immortality comes only with the condition that we are in Christ. Okay, so that's the term. So even though you would think this would make things a lot easier, make the gospel more attractive, given the implications for God, conditionalism continues to encounter significant resistance among persons of faith. This study considers three clusters of impediments to the acceptance of conditionalism. A number of the obstacles are doctrinal, the effects of indoctrination. A handful are biblical, intrinsic to the text of Scripture. Many obstacles are psychological. Perhaps these are the most intractable. Mainstream denominations seldom embrace conditional immortality. Although increasing numbers of individuals are rethinking hell, better chances for large-scale doctrinal change may lie with independent Christian groups. In my experience, as a member of a small Christian movement, approximately 125,000 members in 160 nations, none of the doctrinal, biblical, or psychological obstacles have proved insurmountable. In fact, terminal punishment has won widespread acceptance. Rethinking hell has occurred not only at the grassroots, but also among the vast majority of leaders worldwide. The story of why so many in my denomination have changed their minds has implications for Christian unity, communication, and humility. If you're a member of the Church of Christ or the ICOC, International Church of Christ, and you didn't know that the vast majority of senior leaders accept this position, the position of eternal punishment, you may be in for a surprise, and I hope you'll enjoy this. And if you're from a different wing of the restoration movement or from another Christian group entirely, I hope that the story may give you some encouragement, particularly if it's your purpose to spread this alternate view of God's grace and judgment. And I will pray that God will use this and he will do what he will do. There are six sections. Section one, and this is all adapted from what will be the chapter in the book, because speaking, it's not so interesting when someone just reads everything that's written, but I'll combine reading with commentary. But the first section, I call it the corporal capital paradigm. It's a simple idea. Think of the traditional view that someone dies, goes to heaven or goes to hell, and that experience lasts forever. Consider that against the alternate view that the saved would be with God forever, but those who did not receive God's grace would eventually be destroyed. And I think you can see we need some kind of analogy here. Well, the traditional view I would compare to corporal punishment, infinite corporal punishment. You may remember that analogy. It was like a little parable. Jesus talks about the servant who gets ready when his master is about to come. The other servant doesn't get ready. One is beaten with many blows. One would be beaten with few blows. The idea that punishment would end for some people before others is not possible under the traditional understanding, because there, the beating never ends. It's nonstop, infinite. So corporal punishment. Now, there is an annihilationist view. Some groups believe that when you die, you simply cease to exist. That is your punishment. And I would compare that to capital punishment. It's a second death, so to speak. The terminal view, my view, is corporal followed by capital. That is, punishment appropriate to our level of responsibility, and God is just, God is fair, the punishment lasts as long as it needs to last. And as I reason in my paper, whether that's minutes or millennia is immaterial, because anything, any finite period of time is not infinite. Now, you may say, well, a million years, that's a long time to be in the lake of fire, but a million years would come to an end. 30 seconds would come to an end. In fact, even though they may sound poles apart, miles apart, a million years versus 30 seconds, the truth is they're nearly identical numbers mathematically compared to infinity, if it never stops at all. So again, traditional view, corporal punishment. The annihilationist view, capital punishment. The terminal view, corporal plus capital punishment. And let me mention one other thing here that will be useful as we move through our study. It's technically unrelated to terminal punishment, at least not directly, but we should note that the intermediate state of the dead precedes whatever judgment and destiny the Lord has assigned to us. The intermediate state of the dead. I have at the website a good amount of material on this, but you've heard of Hades, Sheol, the waiting place. So the intermediate state of the dead contrasts with the position of most churches, because most groups say that your ultimate destiny, whether it's glory or gory, begins immediately when you die. I mean, you die and go to heaven. You die and go to hell. People are there already, and so forth. But in effect, not only does the traditional view require infinite punishment, but also a hell that begins the moment we die. But that's wrong. This view is wrong on two counts. Because technically, biblically, there's no hell yet. The judgment day hasn't happened. That's section one, the corporal capital paradigm. And I find that analogies help me to keep in my head concepts that could otherwise become fuzzy. In section two, I talk about the restoration movement. Now, I understand that many of you listening to these podcasts are familiar with the restoration movement. You're probably part of it. And others may actually have done some serious study. If you are a believer not in the restoration movement, you'll appreciate this section, but I think it's important. Few groups actually teach terminal punishment, but there's a promising candidate, a whole fellowship, a whole denomination, if you will, that teaches it, and this is linked with the restoration movement. The restoration movement was originally an ecumenical fusion of Christ followers, serious about rejecting sectarianism and cheap discipleship. The movement took root on both sides of the Atlantic, especially in the 1800s to the mid-1900s. The restoration movement delighted in doctrinal discovery and seems to have taken pleasure, some pleasure at least, in overthrowing sacred cows, despite its historical tendency towards legalism, towards division. The movement actually set forth relatively few doctrinal tenets and rejected creeds and councils and human traditions. So from the days of its roots in Scotland in the late 1600s, the movement exhibited four unifying characteristics. That is, in my own research, I found Church of the Christ in Scotland in the late 1600s. Four characteristics: congregational autonomy, so no superstructure or hierarchy above the local level; leadership by elders, that is, each congregation is led by overseers, not one, but a group, plural leadership. Third, believers' baptism. The movement rejected infant baptism. Baptism is something that you do as an adult. It requires faith. And fourth, weekly communion. So congregational autonomy, leadership by elders, believers' baptism, immersion, and weekly communion. Those are the basic teachings. There's nothing preventing a congregation from going beyond them, you know, accepting a view or rejecting a view, as long as it doesn't conflict with those four, because there's no global headquarters, there's no hierarchy, there's no means of enforcing uniformity like an inquisition. So there's freedom. Now, the Church of Christ have about 1 to 2 million members, but within the Church of Christ, the branch that is least indoctrinated in mainstream Protestant thinking is probably the International Church of Christ, ICOC, with about 125,000 members. Among the ICOC, there's room for multiple understandings of hell. It's not a central doctrine, as long as one's view doesn't contradict the teaching in the Last Judgment, since that's considered non-negotiable in like Hebrews 6. It's one of the fundamental teachings. Then there's a freedom, and that's something that I appreciate. Now, in the Restoration Movement, there are three broad sections: the Disciples of Christ, Church of Christ, and the Christian Churches. You're listening to an adaptation of what will be a chapter in a book. That chapter contains notes, footnotes, some explanations that I did not think would be so interesting for the oral podcast, but please take a look at the paper, take a look at that PDF to see what you're missing, if you feel you are missing anything. But in the Restoration Movement, there are these three groups. The most conservative are the Christian Churches of Christ. The least conservative, the most liberal, if I can use that tag, are the Disciples of Christ. And right in the middle, the Christian Churches. Now, others may put it a different way, but I would put on the spectrum the Disciples of Christ on the left, the Christian Churches in the center, the Churches of Christ on the right. And although the ICOC grew out of the Churches of Christ, its theology is a little more flexible. Reminds me a lot more of the Christian Churches, more moderate. I mean, that's important because if we're hoping that a doctrinal reform can sweep through a church. I don't mean a congregation, but I mean an entire church fellowship. The nature of that fellowship is significant. Obviously, if there's a huge hierarchy, or there are creeds that are used as litmus tests for faith, or there are bands of roving archbishops to enforcing conformity, then it will be very hard for new ideas to take root. Let's go now to section 3, and this is where I share personally. I'll begin to share personally right here. I've called it Rethinking Hell, 1984 to 2014. I first considered conditionalism 30 years ago, and I share my story in the hope that it might assist you in your own study and hopefully will help you to impact others. I came to embrace terminal punishment during my early years on church staff in London. A small team of Americans and Britons planted a church in 1982, and we were building our own teaching curriculum. And we were not afraid to jettison teachings or methods in which we'd been trained if they didn't seem to be working in our part of Europe. We were confident that the Lord would teach us whatever we needed to know. These were heady times. But let me back up a bit. I was confirmed as an Episcopalian in 1972. But interestingly, nothing that we were required to learn in confirmation classes specified the duration of hell, the nature of final punishment. It was left open. In 1976, through my involvement on the fringes of the charismatic movement, that's when I absorbed the traditional view of hell, eternal torment. It was repeated so many times, so many lessons referred to hell or described hell. I assumed that it must be biblical, this view that the lost would be in torment for all time. The lost would roast in hell forever and ever. So this was my view. And perhaps because it was, I seldom shared my Christian faith with others. But then I had not yet committed my life to Christ. Not at that time. That would happen later, once I left home for university. It was actually as a college student that I came into contact with the Restoration Movement, specifically the Churches of Christ. And here we were taught to question tradition, to be on the lookout for errors in biblical interpretation. I was taught that historically the church had begun in a pristine, more apostolic condition and had drifted. And every generation would continue to drift unless we were diligent as students of the Word. A handful of members in our local church believed in the intermediate state of the dead, the waiting place, Sheol or Hades, yet I never heard it taught. And I probably wasn't ready to embrace it anyway. The idea that you wouldn't go immediately to heaven, but you would go to paradise or Tartarus or whatever, seemed complex. It felt to me contrived. I suspect if I had accepted the doctrine of the intermediate state at that time, that I might have ended up accepting terminal punishment more quickly. I say that because the teaching about Hades, the waiting place, overturns most denominations' understanding of judgment and the afterlife. And thus, potentially, it paves the way for a fuller understanding of God's ultimate purposes. I think this is important. Most denominations teach that you die and go straight to heaven or hell. Biblically, there's a waiting place. No one goes to heaven or hell before the last day. What we call the second coming, the general resurrection, the judgment day. Well, if churches are wrong on that, if no one is actually in hell yet, then it becomes a lot easier to consider or reconsider, rethink hell, the nature of hell. If they're wrong on one thing, they might be wrong on another thing. And even for us who are serious about judgment and God's standard of holiness, to believe that right now, on countless millions are suffering in a lake of fire right now is a huge jump, because we don't actually see that in the scriptures. And again, for more on that, please read my book on Heaven or Hell or that short paper on terminal punishment. So I'm still sharing my own story. I began with the conditioning, my background, Episcopalian, Anglican, and then in the charismatic movement, and then eventually with the Church of Christ, where I became a Christian. And now let me talk about conditionalism itself. It was in 1984 that I was first exposed to conditionalism. Again, that immortality is conditional. No one is immortal without faith in Christ. And I was exposed to it through the writing of Edward Fudge. He wrote, his magnum opus is The Fire That Consumes, which has already come out in three editions. And Edward and I have become friends over the years. Initially, when I read this idea that hell might not last forever, that the punishment was eternal, it would not be reversed, but eventually would cease to exist, my heart skipped a beat. This was quite a thought. Later in that same year, after my sister died, which was a seminal event in my faith journey, I began to open up theologically. There are several things I just rethought. Now, some might say I moved in a liberal direction. I like to think I became more honest with the evidence in several different areas of my Christian life. I asked if I might present the terminal view in a staff meeting. By this time, I had started working for the church in London, and I asked our leaders if they would mind if in the next staff meeting I presented the terminal view. Permission was granted. Yes, of course you can, but you'll present both sides, right? I mean, you'll share the terminal view, and then you can share the main view. So almost as though to ask me, show that the terminal view is wrong. But that's a bit unfair, because I was just asked to give a balanced presentation to show the evidence for both sides. I think that was really good. And that was the freedom that I enjoyed on staff. I was on staff for 20 years altogether, which for me helped tremendously fuel my vision for a teaching ministry. I mean, there's not much motivation for a teaching ministry if we've all arrived and we've discovered all truth and there's nothing else to learn. But if there's a kind of frontier and we're all studying and anyone can contribute, that's very motivational. So in that staff meeting, and this again is 1984, I taught both conditionalist and traditionalist views without asking my 20 fellow ministers to come to a firm conclusion themselves. Really, for all of us, this was new territory. And incidentally, the thought that hell might not be a nonstop, infinite experience did nothing to lessen our evangelistic fervor. You know, it's not as though we thought, oh, well, maybe it doesn't last forever. Sin's not that serious. Jesus really isn't unique. It doesn't really matter in the end, because you won't be existing. So let's cool our jets and relax. It was nothing like that. Nothing at all like that. We continued to share our faith. Thousands were baptized. It was an amazing time. And yet, over the following years, I found myself unable to keep these deeper issues out of my mind. It just kept coming back to me, the nature of God, God's grace, and hell. And eventually, I started meeting some other brothers who agreed. And I remember one analogy. A brother said, yeah, it's like The good kids are upstairs in the party, and the bad kids are being tortured downstairs in the basement. You know, what kind of a father would do that? And so I heard some other people's comments, perspectives, analogies that were, to me, they seemed very bold. And I think those analogies emboldened me. In 1990, I shared my new thinking with the principal leaders in my own sphere of ministry. Now, when I was on staff at that time, where I was focused, where our, what we called a world sector at that time, were the British Isles, Nigeria, India, Australia, Southeast Asia, Scandinavia, and soon part of the United States. And of the dozen or so brothers in our discipleship group, only one opposed what I was saying. All the others were open. In fact, we're in agreement. And as my thoughts took shape, crystallized, I wrote a paper. I began to write a paper titled Terminal Punishment. I think that's often the way writing is. People ask me, well, Douglas, how did you come to write this book? Or what gave you this? I organize my thoughts when I teach, and most of the things I've written have emerged out of things that I've taught because I've had to think them through. At any rate, I was captivated. In 1991, with the encouragement of my supervisors, I sent this paper to key leaders globally. I didn't just send it out, you know, fax it out. Fax machines were kind of the rage at that time, or I would use a copying machine and FedEx it. That's a bit more expensive. But I didn't just send it to anyone because I was a bit anxious how this might be received. I sent it rather to everyone in my fellowship whose thinking I respected and people who seemed to be persons of influence. In 1992, I was invited to make a presentation in Los Angeles to the main international leaders of the ICOC. Some may think that this is a very strict movement that would have no tolerance for diversity. That's really not true. This was November 1992. I was welcome to make quite a controversial presentation. In fact, for almost everyone there, this was a new thought. Nearly all accepted it. They accepted terminal punishment. I believe there were 13 of us there that day, myself and 12 others, and everyone accepted it, except one. One was a little bit double-minded, but even later on, he joined our ranks. So it's been gratifying to have the freedom to present a view of final judgment that sits well with my conscience, that makes sense scripturally. And although terminal punishment was never a central focus of my ministry, still isn't, I continued to share my paper, to pen short articles on the topic. And if I was ever asked to teach a workshop on the afterlife, I've interpreted this as a great opportunity to interweave my perspective on terminal punishment. And finally, in 2013, I published What's the Truth About Heaven and Hell? And as a result, I was invited to speak in the first Rethinking Hell Conference in Houston, 2014. So in short, I left traditionalism for terminal punishment, eventually becoming a change agent. That is, I'm not content just to have learned myself what I believe is true. I want others to benefit from that. A change agent. I'm not alone. In my own fellowship, there are several others who've written and have taught the same. And fortunately, terminal punishment has been well received virtually everywhere in the ICOC. That is, I'm aware of only a few very small pockets where usually these are leaders who have not been educated biblically very much. In a few pockets, leaders have been surprised. You know, how could a real Christian believe that? Usually they'll say something like, hell isn't forever. But of course, we believe hell is forever. It's simply the nature of the punishment that we're referring to. These holdouts for traditionalism are becoming fewer and fewer. Now, once again, it's not the purpose now to prove terminal punishment. I've attempted that in the 1991 paper, and I presented further evidence, including opposing viewpoints, in my book. In the next podcast, we'll be in part four, where we actually talk about the obstacles. What prevents people from accepting terminal punishment? Doctrinal hurdles, biblical challenges, even psychological blocks. This is the heart of the paper. And after that, we'll be talking about strategy, how you yourself might make a difference in your own church. Before we close with some important points as far as our own attitude and spirit. This is the end of podcast one. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for number two.